From NPR News, this is a special report on the hearings on Elena Kagan's nomination to the Supreme Court. I'm Linda Wertheimer. This is day two for nominee Elena Kagan, a day when each senator had half an hour to question her, a process which will go on for at least one more day. Most of the questioning was cordial, but there were a few tense moments along the way. The sharpest came at the very beginning of the day, when the nominee was closely questioned about keeping military recruiters off the Harvard Law School campus. Taking his privilege as chairman to go first, Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont attempted to inoculate Kagan against tough questioning he knew was coming.
Did you ever bar recruiters for the U.S. military from access to students at Harvard Law School while you were dean?
Senator Leahy, military recruiters had access to Harvard students every single day I was dean.
Well, let me ask you this. While you were there, did the number of students recruited go down at all while you were dean?
I don't believe it did, Senator Leahy. So I'm confident that the military had access to our students, and our students had access to the military throughout my entire deanship. And that's incredibly important, because the military should have the best and brightest people it can possibly have in its forces. And I think, you know, I said on many, many occasions that this was a great thing for our students to think about doing in their lives, that this is the most important and honorable way any person can serve his or her country.
And it's always been my experience also, if somebody wants to join the military, they usually are pretty motivated to join the military. And my youngest son joined the Marine Corps out of high school. There weren't recruiters on the high school campus, but he was able to find where the recruiter was in downtown Burlington and walked over there and signed up. My wife and I are very proud of him for doing that. But here, there's been this implication given, that's why I wanted you to clear this up, the implication given that somehow military recruiters couldn't recruit Harvard students. That was not the case. Is that correct?
That was not the case, Senator Leahy. The only question that ever came up, as you stated earlier, this was a balance for the law school, because on the one hand, we wanted to make absolutely sure that our students had access to the military at all times, but we did have a very long standing, going back to the 1970s, anti-discrimination policy, which said that no employer could use the Office of Career Services if that employer would not sign a non-discrimination pledge that applied to many categories, race and gender and sexual orientation and actually veterans status as well. And the military could not sign that pledge.
Because of the don't ask, don't tell?
Because of the don't ask, don't tell policy.
Which the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff now says should be repealed.
We'll talk more about this later, but according to Kagan, she organized a compromise in order to deal with Harvard's policy of allowing no recruiters from companies or organizations to operate on the campus if they discriminated against groups named in Harvard's anti-discrimination policy. Congress has passed a law, the Solomon Amendment, which withdraws federal funds from institutions which do not permit military recruiters on campus. That compromise, then, was for Harvard to allow a veterans group to facilitate recruitment on campus, but not permitting military recruiters to go through Harvard's official channels. Senator Jeff Sessions of Alabama, the ranking Republican on the committee, thought Kagan's compromise disrespected the military, which prompted a lengthy and relatively testy exchange. Here's a small part of it, and toward the end you'll hear the chairman intervene.
I tried to make clear in everything I did how much I honored everybody who was associated with the military on the Harvard Law School campus. All that I was trying to do was to ensure that Harvard Law School could also comply with its anti-discrimination policy, a policy that was meant to protect all the students of our campus, including the gay and lesbian students who might very much want to serve in the military, who might very much want to do that most honorable kind of service that a person can do for her country.
Well, I would think that that's a legitimate concern, and people can disagree about that, and I respect your view on that. What I'm having difficulty with is why you would take the steps of treating the military in a second-class way, to speak to rallies, to send out emails, to immediately, without legal basis, because the Solomon Amendment was never at any time not enforced as a matter of law. Why would you would do all those things simply to deny what Congress required, that they have equal access as anyone else?
Senator, the military at all times during my deanship had full and good access. Military recruiting did not go down. Indeed, in a couple of years, including the year that you're particularly referring to, it went up. And it went up because we ensured that students would know that the military recruiters were coming to our campus, because I talked about how important military service was, because our veterans organization and the veterans on campus did an absolutely terrific job, a terrific service to their fellow students in talking to them about the honor of military service.
Well, I would just say, while my time is running down, I'm just a little taken aback by the tone of your remarks, because it's unconnected to reality. I know what happened at Harvard. I know you were an outspoken leader against the military policy. I know you acted without legal authority to reverse Harvard's policy and deny those military equal access to campus until you were threatened by the United States government of loss of federal funds. This is what happened.
The senator's time is expired, but you can respond to that if you want.
Did not happen in that way, and I think if you had any complaint, they should have been made to the United States Congress, not to those men and women who we send in harm's way to serve our nation.
Especially because of the number of people, including the dean of West Point, who has praised you and said that you were absolutely not anti-military. I'll let you respond, take time to respond to what Senator Sessions just said.
Well, thank you, Senator Leahy. I respect and indeed I revere the military. My father was a veteran. One of the great privileges of my time at Harvard Law School was dealing with all these wonderful students that we had who had served in the military and students who wanted to go to the military. And I always tried to make sure that I conveyed my honor for the military, and I always tried to make sure that the military had excellent access to our students. And in the short period of time, Senator Sessions, that the military had that access through the Veterans Organization, military recruiting actually went up. But I also felt a need to protect our, to defend our school's very longstanding anti-discrimination policy, and to protect the men and women, the students who were meant to be protected by that policy, the gay and lesbian students who wanted to serve in the military and do that most honorable kind of service. And those are the two things that I tried to do. And I think, again, the military always had good access at Harvard Law School.
Senator Sessions was not satisfied with Kagan's explanation of what happened at Harvard. Here's what he said to reporters when the committee took a short break. Here's Senator Sessions.
The overall picture that she portrayed of the situation seems to me to be disconnected to the reality of it. And I think that is a serious matter. I believe Supreme Court justice has got to show clarity of mind, the ability to rigorously analyze complex situations and state them clearly and accurately with intellectual honesty. And I got to say that when that examination ended, I felt less comfortable than I did before.
I'm joined by NPR's legal affairs correspondent, Nina Totenberg, and also here is Tom Goldstein. He's the founder of SCOTUS Blog and an attorney at the Washington, D.C. law firm Akin Gump. Tom, Sessions described Kagan as not quite rigorously accurate, as he said, in her description of the dispute between the university and the military recruiters. What's the difference between them?
Well, this dispute goes back a ways. Senator Sessions himself was very involved in creating the law in question, and he really believed that liberal elite law schools were undercutting the military and disrespecting Congress in favor of a liberal cause, gay rights. Elena Kagan, on the other hand, thinks she's fundamentally pro-military. She was trying to get gays into the military, give them the opportunity to serve. They just look at it through very different lenses.
Senator Sessions was pretty hard on Elena Kagan in this exchange. Nina, do you think that did she take a hit? What did it feel like in there?
I think it very much depends where you're coming from. A lot of people associated with the military will see any hesitancy to treat the military as equally as anybody else on campus as an insult. And for those folks, she may have taken a hit. On the other hand, Don't Ask, Don't Tell is now a much more unpopular policy than it was when, even just a few years ago when this was going on. As Chairman Leahy said, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff is now for abolishing it. So it's a very close line to walk for any senator to know how mean to get over something that one cares about intensely.
But the other thing, Tom, you were
going to say? I was just going to say that one measure of whether she's taken a hit is whether the other Republicans followed through during the day. And I agree that this was the most aggressive questioning of her. It was the most intense moment of the day. But I was struck that it didn't become a theme throughout the day.
Sort of as if they thought everything that could safely be said about it had been said about it, or
whatever damage could be done had been done?
I
think so, but that's a bit what I was alluding to. Senator Sessions had been so aggressive. Other people, I think, didn't want to be that aggressive, so they just backed off.
Coming up, we'll talk more about the infamous book review that Elena Kagan wrote. She backpedaled a bit today, plus her approach to executive power. Stay with us. I'm Linda Wertheimer, and you're listening to a special report from NPR News. From NPR News in Washington, you're listening to a special report on hearings before the Senate Judiciary Committee on the nomination of Elena Kagan to be the newest justice on the Supreme Court. I'm Linda Wertheimer. We're taking our review of what happened today in stages. You just heard about one of the most contentious exchanges. Now we're going to go back to the beginning when Chairman Leahy opened the discussion with a personal question asking Kagan about her family. She mentioned her father, a tenants' rights lawyer who interested her in the law, and her mother, who Kagan said was a legendary teacher.
Part of my life is my father and part of my life is my mother. That part of my life has been in public service. I've been really blessed with the opportunities I've had to work in government and to serve this nation. And then part of my life is teaching, which I take enormous pleasure and joy from. I mean, I'm looking over your right shoulder, your left shoulder, right on my side, and there's a student of mine right there, and maybe there are some other students that are around the room, and it's a it's a kind of great thing.
We're doing our best to make Jeremy blush, wouldn't you?
The blushing Jeremy is Jeremy Parrish. He's the Parrish, who is the committee's chief counsel for nominations and a former Kagan student. He was grinning behind the chairman, sitting in the staff seats. Senator Jeff Sessions of Alabama opened his half hour with a quote from Vice President Biden's chief of staff, Ron Klain, who called Kagan a legal progressive with a pragmatic perspective.
Do you agree with that?
Senator Sessions, it's absolutely the case that I have served in two Democratic administrations, and I think...
No, but I'm asking, do you agree with the characterization that you are a legal progressive?
Senator Sessions, I honestly don't know what that label means. I've worked in two Democratic administrations. Senator Graham suggested yesterday, and I think he's right, that you can tell something about me and my political views from that. But as I suggested to you, that my political views are one thing.
Well, but I agree with you exactly that you should not be condemned for being a political believer and taking part in the process and having views. But I'm asking about his firm statement that you're a legal progressive, which means something. I think he knew what he was talking about. He's a skilled lawyer. He's been in the midst of the great debates of this country about law and politics, just as you have. And so I ask you again, do you think that is a fair characterization of your views? Certainly you don't think he was attempting to embarrass you or hurt you in that process, do you?
I love my good friend Ron Klain, but I guess I think that people should be allowed to label themselves. And that's, I don't know what that label means, and so I guess I'm not going to characterize it one way or the other.
Well, I would just say, having looked at your overall record, having considered those two people who know you very well, I think you have to classify you as someone in the theme of the legal progressive.
Senator Herb Kohl, Democrat of Wisconsin, continued today in his effort to pin Kagan down on how she'd conduct herself as a justice if she's confirmed, and she continued her resistance to specifics.
Well, I think this is a good time to refer to your 1995 Law Review article in which you criticized Supreme Court.
It's been half an hour since I heard about that article.
Here we are. You said back then, when the Senate ceases to engage nominees in meaningful discussions of legal issues, the confirmation process takes on an air of vacuity and farce, and the Senate becomes incapable of either properly evaluating nominees or appropriately educating the public. However, more recently, in the meeting that we had, you indicated that you had reconsidered these views, and I think we're getting some indication of that here at the moment. How do you feel about that reconsideration versus what you said back in 1995?
Well, Senator Kohl, I do think that much of what I wrote in 1995 was right, but that I in some measure got a bit of the balance off. So what I wrote in 1995 was that the Senate had an important role to play, that the Senate should take that role very seriously, that the Senate should endeavor to think about what a nominee was, what kind of justice a nominee would make, and that was all appropriate. And I also said that I thought it was appropriate for nominees to be as forthcoming as they possibly could be. And I continue to believe that, and I am endeavoring and will endeavor to do so. I did think, as I suggested earlier, that I got the balance a little bit off. I said then, even then in that 1995 article, that it was inappropriate for a nominee to ever give any indication of how she would rule in a case that would come before the court. And I think, too, it would be inappropriate to do so in a somewhat veiled manner by essentially grading past cases. But I do think it's very appropriate for you to question me about my judicial philosophy on the kinds of sources I would look to at interpreting the Constitution or interpreting a statute, about my general approach to judicial decision-making, about the degree to which I would defer or not defer to acts of Congress and the states. I mean, all of those things, I think, ought to be a subject of debate.
Well, back in that 1995 article, you wrote that one of the most important inquiries for any nominee, as you are here today, is to, quote, inquire as to the direction in which he or she would move the institution. In what direction would you move the court?
Well, Senator Kohl, I do think that is the kind of thing all I can say, Senator Kohl, is that I will try to decide each case that comes before me as fairly and objectively as I can. I can't tell you I'll move the court in a particular way on a particular issue because I just don't know what cases.
Well, you said in 1995 it is a fair question to ask a nominee, in what direction, this is your quote, would you move the court?
Well, it might be a fair question.
I'm not going to get necessarily a All right, let's move on. Comparison to other judges. General Kagan.
Elena Kagan said earlier that she had begun to reconsider her view that nominees should be frank about their thoughts on issues when she and Orrin Hatch talked during her previous confirmation hearings, the hearings to be Solicitor General. Senator Dianne Feinstein had a somewhat more candid exchange with Kagan. The California Democrat began with a question about guns.
Now, I want to just have a little heart-to-heart talk with you, if I might. I come at the subject...
Just you and me.
Just you and me and nobody else.
Don't anybody in the room listen.
I come at the subject of guns probably differently than most of my colleagues. I think I've seen too much. You know, I wrote the assault weapons legislation. I found the body of Harvey Milk. I became mayor as a product of assassination. I've watched as innocent after innocent has been killed, the latest of which in my state is 2 weeks ago, a six-year-old in a Spider-Man costume eating an ice cream bar in the kitchen was killed by a bullet coming through the room.
Feinstein voiced her concerns about two recent Supreme Court decisions, including one issued yesterday, which says that gun control measures adopted by states and cities can now be challenged under the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms.
Why is a 5-4 decision in two quick cases, why does it throw out literally decades of precedent in the Heller case in your mind? Why do these two cases become settled law?
Senator Feinstein, because the court decided them as they did. And once the court has decided a case, it is binding precedent. Now, there are various reasons for why you might overturn a precedent. If the precedent proves unworkable over time, or if the doctrinal foundations of the precedent are eroded, or if the factual circumstances that were critical to why the precedent to the original decision, if those change. But unless one can sort of point to one of those reasons for reversing a precedent, the operating presumption of our legal system is that a judge respects precedent. And I think that that's an enormously important principle of the legal system, that one defers to prior justices or prior judges who have decided something, and that it's not enough, even if you think something is wrong, to say, oh, well, that decision was wrong. They got it wrong. That the whole idea of precedent is that's not enough to say that a precedent is wrong. You assume that it's right and that it's valid going forward.
Feinstein then moved on to executive powers, specifically the powers of the president in wartime. This is an area where many liberals have concerns about what Kagan might do if she does take a seat on the Supreme Court.
Some on the left have criticized your views on executive power, finding fault with your testimony during your 2009 confirmation hearing as Solicitor General, in which you agreed with Senator Lindsey Graham that the law of armed conflict provides sufficient legal authority for the president to detain individuals suspected of terrorist ties without trial. You also agreed that the courts have a role in determining whether a particular detention is lawful, and that substantive due process is required before an individual may be detained. You agreed during the aforementioned hearing that an individual suspected of financing al-Qaeda in the Philippines was, quote, part of the battlefield, end quote, for the purpose of capture and detention. Could you elaborate on the scope of the president's authority to detain individuals under the law of armed conflict?
Senator Feinstein, the conversation that Senator Graham and I had, and I believe in that same hearing you asked a similar question, starts with the Hamdi case, where the Supreme Court said that the AUMF, the Authorization for the Use of Military Force, which is the statute that applies to our conflict with Iraq and Afghanistan, that the AUMF includes detention authority, detention authority, and Hamdi said that the law of war typically grants such authority in a wartime situation, and interpreted the AUMF consistent with that law of war understanding. Now, the question of exactly what the scope of that detention authority is has been and continues to be the subject of a number of cases. And in the role of Solicitor General, I've participated in some of those issues.
Feinstein then raised warrantless wiretaps and pressed Kagan on whether she believes the president has powers that Congress has not specifically given him, or even if the president has the power to do something that Congress has actually forbidden him to do.
I would say that the circumstances in which the president can act as against specific congressional legislation, where the president can act despite Congress, are few and far between. And I think that that's what Justice Jackson said in Youngstown. And I think that that's what mostly the court has agreed with, few and far between. Now, are they non-existent? Well, suppose Congress said something like, we're going to take away the president's pardon power, a power that's specifically committed to the president by Article 2. I think that that would be a hard case. I think the court might say, well, you know, notwithstanding that Congress tried to do that, Congress can't do that. The president has that power, and it doesn't matter what Congress says about the matter. But those are very few and far between. For the most part, the presumption is that the president, if told by Congress that he can't do something, can't do something.
I'm here with NBR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg and with Tom Goldstein. He's the founder of SCOTUS blog. So, Tom, she talked about executive power. The issue came up later with South Carolina Republican Lindsey Graham. And she seemed to feel that there might be some limits on the president's power to hold detainees. This was there was something, I mean, you thought this was an unusually frank moment in the hearings.
Well, I do think that Elena Kagan probably succeeded in charting a middle ground on executive power, which basically boils down for America to the idea of what can the president do in the war on terror and holding people without trial. To conservatives, she pointed to the pro-government brief she filed as the Solicitor General. To liberals, she pointed to the fact that as a justice, maybe she wouldn't, you know, follow those positions that she had taken for the government. I do think that liberals, who are the ones who are most concerned about executive power, will be probably happier with an exchange she had with Senator Dianne Feinstein on abortion, which came and went pretty quickly, but maybe will get overlooked. And that is, she said that she understood existing law to require under the Constitution that if you are going to restrict the right to abortion, you have to have an exception for health or life of the mother. The Supreme Court had recently rejected that position in upholding a federal statute on so-called partial birth abortion, but she said that precedent was pretty narrowly limited.
Nina, another question where she runs into difficulties with her supporters on the left in some instances is guns, and that was something that Feinstein asked her about. When pressed on it, she came back to her position that Heller and McDonald must be considered settled law. These are basically the elimination of the potential for eliminating gun control laws. The presumption must be in favor of precedent, she says. So do you think, you know, who's she upsetting here?
Well, she clearly upset Dianne Feinstein, who's been a big advocate for gun control and who, remember, made her reputation early in her life as a city councilwoman in San Francisco when she tried to staunch the bleeding and failed of the mayor, George Moscone, after he'd been fatally shot. But we have to remember who we're dealing with here, and I think you see several things. Elena Kagan is a realist. She doesn't want gun control to be an issue in these hearings. President Obama doesn't want that either. This is a president who, as a candidate, said he believed in the Second Amendment right to bear arms. Russ Feingold from Wisconsin today said he believed in an individual right to bear arms. The critical question with guns now is, what are reasonable restrictions? And no Republican asked her that.
Now, Elena Kagan sort of dodged again and again on issues that she said might come up before the court, and she repeatedly refused to offer opinions about Supreme Court rulings. She did seem to make an exception When she talked about the much-discussed Citizens United case, she described as having convinced herself of her position. She seemed to feel more comfortable talking about things that she actually had argued before the Supreme Court.
And then she went on to say, but I want to make a very clear difference between the role of an advocate, which is I was when I did this job, and my role would be as a judge. If you watch the body language, if you watch the hearing, I think that Elena Kagan convinced herself on this question, but can I prove it? No.
The one thing I will say is that it's notable that Republicans or whoever's in the minority and is opposed to a particular nominee often complains, I'm not getting enough information, you're not answering my questions. And you really didn't hear that from the Republicans. She did seem to engage them. There were things, true, she wouldn't answer, but there are questions she really shouldn't answer, and they seem to accept how forthcoming she is, even if they don't agree with her.
Nina, you said yesterday that she would talk about the law and dazzle them with her conversation about the law. And I kept thinking about what you had said as I watched today.
Well, all of that conversation about what a judge does and what is an originalist and in what sense are we all originalists and what subjects are already settled and what ones aren't already settled and what a judge should bring to bear in her mind, all of that was very dazzling in a lot of ways. And then she was a charming witness. She even blushed a couple of times.
Well, we'll hear more of that sort of charm on display, I guess. Coming up, Elena Kagan's mentor, Justice Thurgood Marshall, comes up again. There'll be more questions about the value of the hearings themselves. And Tom and Nina will be back with us. I'm Linda Wertheimer, and you're listening to special coverage from NPR News. From NPR News in Washington, a special report on hearings before the Senate Judiciary Committee, the nomination of Elena Kagan to be the newest justice on the Supreme Court. Following a theme on the Republican side from yesterday's opening statements, Senator John Kyle, Republican of Arizona, asked Kagan again about the views of Justice Thurgood Marshall, for whom she clerked. Some of the Republicans on the committee have characterized Marshall as an activist, which they don't regard as a good thing. Kagan distanced herself somewhat from Marshall, responding lovingly but decisively.
Let me just cite one thing you wrote about Justice Marshall's view, and I'm quoting now. You said, in Justice Marshall's view, constitutional interpretation demanded, above all else, that the courts show a special solicitude for the despised and disadvantaged. It was the role of the courts in interpreting the Constitution to protect the people who went unprotected by every other organ of government, to safeguard the interests of people who had no other champion. The court existed primarily to fulfill this mission, you wrote about Justice Marshall. And in fact, you also wrote that if he had his way, cases involving the disadvantaged would have been the only cases the Supreme Court heard. What's unclear to me is whether you agree with Justice Marshall's view of the role of the court in constitutional interpretation.
Senator Kyle, the last statement you read, the statement about it would be the only case, I think that was a kind of jokey statement, so I would put that aside.
Okay.
I think what I was saying in that piece is consistent with what I've said to you. I think Justice Marshall's whole life, and this is why I said he revered the Supreme Court, Justice Marshall's whole life was about seeing the courts take seriously claims that were not taken seriously anyplace else. So in his struggle for racial justice, you know, he could go to the state houses or he could go to Congress or the president, and those claims generally were ignored.
Well, let me just interrupt for a second. You wrote here that in constitutional interpretation, so this is not just a factual matter between two parties, we're talking about interpreting the Constitution. He says the courts should show a special solicitude.
Well, I think that was my words, and I meant,
yes,
I meant special as compared with the other branches of government. In other words, that it was the court's role to make sure that even when people have no place else to go, that they can come to the courts and the courts will hear their claims fairly. And that was what I was saying was a wonderful thing about courts, a miraculous thing about courts, that you can be ignored in every other part of the government. And you can come to a court, and a court will say, it's our job to treat you with respect, with consideration, with the same kind of attention we give to everybody else.
Well, let me just ask you, do you believe then, and it's hard, I realize, though you certainly know, you knew Justice Marshall very well, you knew his reasoning, that he would have agreed with Justice Roberts that if the big guy has the law on his side, the big guy wins, if the little guy does, then the little guy wins, and that's consistent with what Justice Marshall believed. Or would he have expressed it more along the lines that some of my colleagues have here, that there's too much agreement with the corporate interests and big business, as one of my colleagues put it?
Senator Kyl, I guess 2 points. The first is, I guess I don't want to spend a whole lot of time trying to figure out exactly what Justice Marshall would have said with respect to any question, because the most important thing, I love Justice Marshall. He did an enormous amount for me. But if you confirm me to this position, you'll get Justice Kagan. You won't get Justice Marshall. Well, and that's an important thing.
In the senator's pursuit of Kagan's philosophy, they frequently mentioned her years working in the Clinton White House as advisor and as legal counsel to the president. Some senators have characterized her as political. Senator Russell Feingold, Democrat of Wisconsin, suggested that her political experience might give her an advantage on the court.
It seems to me that you were quite aware of the need to think critically and legally, as well as politically, as you carried out your responsibilities. Can you say a little bit about the process of reviewing draft legislation in the counsel's office and the importance of developing legislation that is consistent with Supreme Court precedent as it exists at the time?
Kagan answered that the White House is where politics, policy, and the law come together. This is near the end of her answer.
My experience in the White House during the 1990s is valuable in one sense, which is that it taught me to very much respect the other branches of government. You know, I'm not a person whose experience is only and all about courts. I don't think courts are all there is in this government. I think that the political branches, Congress and the president, are incredibly important actors and should be making most of the decisions in this country. Courts do police these constitutional boundaries, do ensure that Congress and the president don't overstep their role, don't violate people's individual rights. But when it comes to policy, it ought to be courts that do, it ought to be Congress and the president that do the policy making. And the courts ought to respect that and ought to defer to that. And I think that my experience in the executive branch and dealing a lot with Congress has made me very respectful of the president's role and Congress's role in our government.
Most of the questioning of Kagan has been good-natured, finding a certain kind of humor in the lack of information that the senators have about what Kagan might do as justice. Republican Senator Charles Grassley of Iowa went all the way back to Kagan's years in graduate school.
You wrote in your Oxford thesis, quote, "Judges will have goals, and because this is so, judges will often try to mold and steer the law in order to promote certain ethical values and achieve certain social ends. Such activity is not necessarily wrong or invalid." And then in addition, quote, "and yet no court should make or justify its decisions solely by reference to demands of social justice. Decisions should be based upon legal principle and reason. They should appeal no less to our intellectual than to our ethical sense. If a court cannot justify a ruling in terms of legal principle, then the court should stay its hand. No judge should hand down a decision that cannot plausibly be grounded in principles referable to an accepted source of law. If, on the other hand, a court can justify a ruling in terms of legal principle, then the court must make every effort to do so. Judicial decisions must be based above all on law and reason. Is it appropriate for judges to mold and steer the law?"
Senator Grassley, all I can say about that paper is that it's dangerous to write papers about the law before you've spent a day in law school. So I wrote that paper before I spent a day in law school. I was trying to think about whether to go to law school, and I decided to write a paper about law in order to figure out whether I was interested in the subject. And I discovered that I was interested in the subject, and I went to law school, where I found out that I might have been interested in the subject, but I didn't know much about the subject at the time. And so I would ask you to recognize that I didn't know a whole lot of law then, and there are I didn't know a whole lot of law then.
You know, if I accept your answer, it's going to spoil a whole 5 minutes I had here. But let me...
Chuck, go ahead and accept it.
let me enjoy it anyway, will you?
Once again, that interjection came from the chairman, Pat Leahy. One of the testy moments in the afternoon session came from Senator Arlen Specter, Democrat of Pennsylvania, who had a list of specific questions he felt Kagan dodged. He repeatedly interrupted her and finally gave up and told his colleagues and the nominee that if questions cannot be answered in a proceeding like this one, why bother?
There's a lot of concern in the Senate about the value of these hearings. When we have the kinds of declarations at that table, your predecessor nominees on deference to Congress, and then there's none given. Not to jolt the system and be modest, and there's a 180-degree U-turn. And we wonder what we can do about it. Judicial independence is the bulwark of this republic. Judicial independence gives us the rule of law, and it is our most highly prized value. And while the Congress and the executive branch fumbled on segregation for decades, really centuries, the court came along and acted on the subject in a progressive way, a very progressive way, in a very activistic way. Nobody challenges it on either side of the aisle today. So we really have the highest respect for judicial independence. But what do we do when we confirm nominees and they don't follow through on very flat commitments? This is not just my view. The view of Richard Posner is very, very tough in his book, How Judges Think. And this is what he has to say about the subject I'm addressing, quote, less than 2 years after his confirmation, referring to Chief Justice Roberts, he demonstrated by his judicial votes and opinions that he aspires to make changes in significant areas of constitutional law. The tension between what he said at his confirmation hearing and what he is doing as a justice is a blow to Roberts' reputation for candor and further debasement of the already debased currency of the testimony of nominees at judicial confirmation hearings, close quote. Now, we're trying to raise the level of that currency. I don't believe you want to make a comment about that, but if you do, you're welcome to.
Senator Specter, I assume the good faith of everybody who sits in this chair, and there's no reason in my mind to think otherwise.
We've included several humorous moments from the hearing, and we don't want to leave out what was the best one-liner when Senator Lindsey Graham led Kagan on by asking her what she was doing on Christmas Day. She assumed it was a way to lead into the attempted terrorist incident this past Christmas.
I just asked you where you were at on Christmas.
You know, like all Jews, I was probably at a Chinese restaurant.
Great answer. Great answer.
You know, I could almost see that one coming. And I thought, yeah.
Me too. So you were celebrating
Hanukkah. Senator Schumer explained this to me earlier.
Yeah, he did.
If so I might, no other restaurants are open.
That was the chairman, Pat Leahy, and the senator from New York, Charles Schumer, who made those little offerings at the end. We're still here. NPR's legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg and Tom Goldstein. He's the founder of SCOTUS blog. Nina, it sounded as if the Christmas line sort of brought the house down. It seemed as though in all sorts of moments, Kagan or somebody sort of disarmed the crowd, the committee, the event, with something humorous.
Well, it was very reminiscent of John Roberts. Had a one-liner about Casablanca that was at Chuck Schumer's expense in his confirmation hearing. That also brought the house down, and I guarantee you that the Chinese restaurant was in every broadcast in America today. It was one of her moments when she did blush. I'm very curious to know whether Senator Graham deliberately set her up in the best sense of the word for the great one-liner, or whether he just sort of stumbled into it. I suspect it's the former and not the latter.
Well, that's a sort of there's a kind of an inbuilt attitude of friendliness or cordiality or something in these hearings, which I mean, what is it? Is it that they don't have any doubt that she's going to be confirmed, so they talk about whatever they want to talk about, but they don't basically treat this as a super serious event?
Well, Republicans don't have control of the Senate. If they had control of the Senate, if they really thought they could defeat this nominee, this would be a lot more difficult a proceeding. And if she makes a mistake, you'll see how fast it switches. If she doesn't, though, it's a little bit like, as I think I said in one of the pieces I did last week, it's a bit like hurling themselves against a brick wall. They're not getting anywhere, so, and they don't have a coordinated and orchestrated mission here. You take this, I'll take that, we'll come back with each other. There's no real sense that this is doable, I think. So nobody has spent an enormous amount of time on it, with the possible exception of Senator Sessions.
The one thing I would say is that it's consequential, because when everybody's kind of laughing it up, it's very hard to depict her as a threat to the Republic. So you're not going to get the impression throughout the country that this is a radical nomination. On the other hand, I wouldn't take away from this that she's actually persuading anyone. This is a political process. The Republicans are taking a stand against Democratic nominees, and everybody that was going to vote against her going into the hearings is going to vote against her after the hearings.
There does seem to be, I suppose, some value in a kind of charm offensive. I mean, as we saw when the Chief Justice was up for confirmation the first time, Chief Justice John Roberts was extraordinarily charming in his hearings. He's so, so smart, and everyone was enormously impressed with him. I mean, maybe that's like the model.
Well, and he got half the Democratic votes. With the Sotomayor nomination, where I never really saw what was in it for voting for her, what was in it for voting against her for Republicans, I think there were only seven or eight votes for her. And I don't expect anything much different this time. And in fact, about half the votes last time for Sotomayor were from senators who are retiring. So they were never going to face the voters, and they just acted in much more the tradition that we have in previous eras understood, which is unless you have a really good reason to vote against a Supreme Court nominee, the president gets to have his nominee. But that isn't the rule anymore.
Well, and now Republicans face threats from the right as much as anything else. People like Orrin Hatch, who would like to, I think, be relatively moderate in these situations, faces a situation in Utah where his colleague, Senator Bennett, was kind of kicked out by the right, and they feel politically essentially bound to vote against any nominee from Barack Obama, I think.
Let me ask you about all of the senators on both sides of the aisle who've been trying to get Elena Kagan to say something specific about what kind of justice she would be, where she would like to take the court, what would be her philosophy. She's pretty much just stonewalled that as well. I mean, do you think that there were any, did anybody get anywhere?
Well, you know, it's a very interesting proposition here. It's all atmospherics. And if you've been around a while, and these senators have, and even Tom and I have, you understand the atmospherics. So when we heard John Roberts testify, or Sam Alito, none of us had any doubt that these men, if confirmed, would be pretty conservative justices, pretty hard right. And it's turned out to be a correct forecast. Contrast that with Elena Kagan. You listen to her today, and the words she used and the way she phrased things, there isn't much doubt in my mind that she will be a left-of-center justice. But can I prove it? No, I can't prove that any more than I could have proved what kind of a justice John Roberts was going to be or Sam Alito. They know how to answer questions.
We're going to have more of those questions coming up tomorrow. Thank you both for coming in, NPR's legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg and Tom Goldstein of SCOTUS Blog. He's an attorney at the law firm Akin Gump. Thank you very much, both of you, for being here. I'm Linda Wertheimer, and you are listening to a special report from NPR News.